Before I was a practitioner, I mean, I guess I was kind of dabbling in meditation, but I wasn't really practicing with any degree of commitment. My sons were about, I think my youngest son was probably about 4 or 5. So Raymond would have been about 10 years old, the oldest. And I want to show you how feeling tones and craving intersect with each other and how it moves us along moment by moment by moment by moment. Because what we're learning here with dependent origination is not just, oh, I should notice when I have pleasant or unpleasant, but I thought the way, excuse me, I thought the way Lauren did her meditation, it is perfect. There's a way in which meditation helps us see something that we can't see when we're normally living. And that's the distinction. It's almost why we need to meditate. So I'm going to show you how things move along moment to moment to moment to moment. And then I'll see if I can tie it into, you know, what we're supposed to be talking about. It was a Friday after work. It was a nice day, sunny. And so I picked up the boys and we were on our way home. And I just was in this really good mood, like, I don't have to go to work. It's the weekend. We're gonna chill out, relax, and we're just gonna have a good time. You know, it's gonna be a good time. That feeling. So in the car, we were kind of laughing and joking and telling, making weird sounds and things like that. So we get to the apartment and I open the door and my apartment was in this total disarray. And it was just so, it just looked, so much stuff everywhere. I don't know. I hit that door and I just descended into this dreaded moment. And I think the boys didn't understand, right? So they were looking at me like, what's wrong? What's wrong? And I didn't want to tell them that I had descended. I couldn't understand. So I'm telling you this story from a Dharma perspective, but at that moment, I didn't understand what was happening. I just felt dejected and miserable. So I made up a lie. I may have told this to Sims at one point, but I made up a lie and I said, oh, I wanted to do something special for you guys, but I can't. The house is a mess. I just don't feel up to it now. And I really wanted to do something special, but I didn't really have anything special for them. I was just making that up to try to grapple with the fact that I had changed so dramatically in my personality, that my temperament had changed, and I was just making something up. And so they said, oh, don't worry about it. You lay down and we'll clean the house. And so I lay on the couch and they're scurrying about cleaning and sweeping and cleaning and sweeping and cleaning and sweeping. And every once in a while, I would wake up and see all this kerfuffle and the movement of things and the ordering around by my oldest boy to the youngest one. Like, yeah, you take care of that and take that trash over there and all this stuff. But I was so into the sleep and the resting of it, I wasn't really, I completely forgot all about what I had promised, what I said, the whole world, everything shifted. And then they wake me up. And they're all excited because the house is clean now, ready for their surprise. And they are poking and poking at me like Christmas morning. If you ever had kids, they wake up at like 2 a.m. and they're like, okay, let's go, let's go. And they were poking at me. And I'm kind of now wanting to sleep and like go away. And I remembered that they are waiting for their surprise, right? So they're poking and then they would stand there and look at me giggling. So I get up and I said, well, okay, I got to inspect the place. I don't know. So I'm walking through the house and they really did a good job. And I'm thinking to myself, I don't really have any surprise. I don't really have anything. I made it up in the moment. And so now I am caught in this trying to think of something. Walking through the house, they're all excited. I'm actually feeling much better because the house is now orderly and it feels more in, you know, it doesn't feel heavy anymore. So I'm walking through and I said, okay, I think you earned it. The surprise is cereal in the big bowl. That's so they always like to eat a box of cereal in a giant bowl. I don't know what the deal is with boys and cereal, big bowls, big spoons. And I said, it's cereal in the big bowl. That, it electrified them. They were like running through the house with all this joy. They picked out which box of cereal they wanted for dinner. And we sat and watched these, back then it was VHS kind of tapes of all these superheroes. We watched superheroes in the living room with this cereal in these big bowls, big giant spoons. That's what our dinner was. And it was the best time. It was this, there was something about this moment that stuck with me. And over years of practice, I think I understand. I think looking back, I can understand why this had the effect on me that it had. And with what Dhamma points to, it's what Lauren was kind of pointing to in her practice. Because in our normal walking around existence, we don't pay attention to what is pushing us into wherever we're going. We don't pay attention to that. We're just going, 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 going. And when you practice meditation and you point out things like noticing these different objects, noticing the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral experience, noticing the how you're reacting to it, you're not doing anything because you're just sitting there. And sometimes we want our meditations to be like I go away, I'm deep in some place, and I'm the outside world is no more, and I'm gone and peaceful in this kind of secluded way. But the best meditations are the ones where you are aware of what the mind-body system is doing. This dependent origination, this understanding the how of what's going on. The why you can get to, but the understanding of that, hearing that sound, deciding the mind, labeling it as pleasant or unpleasant, and then this wishing it would go away and all the talking that comes. When you're sitting doing nothing, you can begin to observe that process. And oftentimes it involves a lot of thinking and a lot of connecting and it involves a lot of stuff going on. So if we're just trying to rest back in seclusion, rather than just from this still watching, then we are trying to not see that. We want to just go to the resting place, and that's what is a good meditation. But in reality, a good meditation is noticing and remembering what happened. So in that story I told, the thing that has always captured me about it is how much I noticed this changing in my emotional energy, this changing in my sensory experience moment by moment by moment. It really is irrelevant about everything else. But I'd say the whole span was about an hour. Even if I include the time I was sleeping and in and out of sleep and watching, kind of half watching the boys. But in the course of an hour, I went through these vast shifts of pleasant, unpleasant, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, pleasant, unpleasant. And that is what moved me through the day. Can you see that? That's what moved me from the moment I got in that car with the boys until I put him in the bed. All day I was being moved. I mean, that whole period, I was being moved by whether I liked something or didn't like something, or how I, you know, how the mind felt about something. This is where we're at in this dependent origination place. This month and next month are going to feel like deja vu. Next month's going to feel like deja vu to this month, because this month we're talking about craving and next month we're talking about clinging. And the example I want to show you of this craving and clinging has to do with how I reacted. This is the second thing I think is important, why I chose the story. That dread that descended upon me when I stepped into that apartment, that's not the first time I had that kind of experience. But in this period, I didn't stay with it. Usually I would get into that dread place and I would get stuck in it. And I would just be like, I can't do it, you guys. You know, I would maybe make them just sit and watch TV. Don't talk to me. And maybe I would get up and go get something to eat for them later on. Or, you know, maybe I'd make them a sandwich or something like that. But I could get stuck in that kind of unhappiness, and then I would stay there. I would get caught in the thinking papancha of the whole thing, and I would start dwelling there. Or sometimes I could open the door and the house was a mess. We're all laughing and playing, and I could say, hey, you guys, let's make a game and let's get the house all cleaned up and blah, blah, blah. I could keep that energy upbeat. I could get stuck in the upward swing of the energy. What I think we're doing at craving is we are in the place where I was that day. We are in the place where we can begin to notice how we are driven by this feeling tone, reactivity to it, connection. We're beginning to see this. It'll be harder to see it when we get to clinging, because we're so glued to it, we won't be able, it's much harder to unpull ourselves from it. So this place at clinging and craving, we're at the place where we can see this wanting mind and what happens with it, how it pushes us. So I wanted to point out a couple of things. This idea of attachment that we're really talking about, or I guess you could think of it as, let's start back a couple steps back. Mindfulness, I'm going to turn off my phone here. Mindfulness is, that can be like that is like the protector. And Vedana is the guard. So Vedana is the glue that glues all of our preset conditioning together. all that conditioning we talked about from January to now is glued together with this Vedana. And when we experience that Vedana, it is pushing us, almost like the engine that, okay, we don't like it. The body knows what to do. It knows to push it away, get rid of it. It starts planning how it can do that. So we are at this crossroads here at craving, where we can begin to experience and see this attachment that I think it has attached at craving, and that attachment gets stronger by clinging. But some people say that the attachment doesn't actually occur until there's clinging. But to me, we are at this intersection here where we can begin to see how all of this puts together, how my conditioning puts me into these places. We're not trying to stop the contact. There's nothing wrong with me walking in the door and feeling dejected, or, you know, making up some story and changing the scenario. All these things are all just part of life and the way we live when we're just living. But when it becomes important is when we can begin to notice we are stuck. We are glued to some pancha, or in this tradition, it's the proliferation of thought around that Vedana that is the problem. That is what we're going to talk about next month. This month, we're really talking about the coming together and the beginning to be aware that I am connected, I guess you could say. What gets us in trouble is that proliferation arises and we get caught in the reactivity, and then we stay there. And then we don't have any, it's almost like we have to chisel ourselves out of that thinking pattern. This attachment that's happening is happening because we have put some special value on the moment. We've put some special value on it. So the attachment is not about the object itself or the moment itself. It's not about my apartment. When I hit that door, it's not about my apartment. It seems like it is, but it's really about the value that I put on my apartment being disarrayed. That somehow or another, if the apartments didn't disarray, I can't be happy. Sorry, you guys, dropped all my papers. So this is the dilemma that we're in, is this seeing the value, the added value I'm giving to something. If we can see the added value that I'm giving to something, we can interrupt that clinging. Because once we cling, we're so infused with it that we cannot see the added value. That thing and the added value become one. And now the difficulty we're going to have next month is, how do I let go of something that I have now glued together as with this added value? So we want to see maybe added value is specialness, you could say. That's another way you could say it. But somehow begin to see that this is going to trigger some of our thinking, but this is Dhamma, so I'm going to have to say it this way. Everything we think of as pleasant or unpleasant or neither is not in fact pleasant or unpleasant or neither. It is our imbued opinion, our imbued value on that. harm is different than that. Harm is more universal in its understanding, in its capacity. So when we are caught up in, when we're practicing this month, we're not trying to put judgment on ourselves. We're just trying to see, can I begin to see that I'm the one that's saying this is pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, or neither. It's not the moment. It's not the experience. It's not the object. It's me that's deciding that. And if I could begin to see that it's me that's deciding that, I could begin to see that it is, that there is the possibility it is other than that. And if I could see it's other than that, now I'm getting to a much wider, more realistic relationship with what's going on around me. It doesn't mean that we would change or rearrange what we're thinking as much as it means we will not get caught up in the proliferation and the reactivity that we get caught up in around it. Let me see if there's one other thing I wanted to address. So we could begin to see how, this is the last thing, and then we'll get into some groups and kind of talk about it. But we all have these judgments, like my judgment, that I can't be happy if the house is disarrayed, that somehow, like you might have I can't cook in a dirty kitchen, those kind of things. The kitchen has to be clean if I'm going to start cooking. So I got to send the boys in there to go clean up the kitchen so I can cook dinner. That kind of energy. You might have, there are all kinds of assumptions, like I'm not smart or I'm not good enough or, you know, I'm a slob or I'm a tomboy. You know how we judge children and we give them a title and then they live into that title and we grow up with that title. Whatever that title was our parents and the adults around us gave us, the other kids around us gave us, we begin to live into that title as if that's what I am. So when we are at when we're at the craving stage, when we're learning to begin to feel into the Vedana, the felt sense of a moment, feeling into the unpleasantness, and with mindfulness in front of us, we can begin to stop these automatic assumptions at the gate. Because these assumptions come with feeling tones. Some of my best moments in retreat have been in dining halls. I would go to the dining hall and I would sit there and it was the quiet during the retreat and the dishes clinging, everybody, you know, moving gently amongst each other and the smell of the food and the just the sounds of people in the kitchen doing kitcheny stuff. Something about this always just, if I go to the dining hall for tea, even in moments when I'm feeling really heavy or having a difficult moment, I feel so alive. And I never understood why that was. And I was sitting at a retreat one time, one of those long retreats, so the mind is way more open. And I closed my eyes and drifted back to a time when I was in high school. I had such a trauma-driven life at home. But the times when I would be the most free would be Denny's used to let, I don't know if they still do, but they used to let people come in and all you had to buy was coffee. So we would pull our money together And we would buy this thing of coffee. And we would sit there and get the free refills and drink coffee and talk for hours. And I realized when I was sitting at this retreat that I have such a pleasant relationship with the sound of restaurants. That for some reason to me, if we go to a restaurant and we sit down and we eat, now we're really, this is a good meal. We're having a good time, good friends. But you may have the exact, you may say, no, I don't want to go to a restaurant. I want to sit at home together with friends. We think that's the good thing. We don't really realize that all of that is coming from January to June or January to July. Our habit patterns have created this conditioning and our bodies are telling us this is the good thing. For me, it's being at a restaurant with friends. For you, it's sitting at home. For some people, it's the picnic. For some people, it's like just being able to sit by myself in front of the TV and know everybody's leaving me alone. Don't talk to me. I just have my little dinner. Got my, just don't talk to me. It's all very different for all of us. The conflicts begin to come, you can see, because once we have next month, we're clinging to it. We think this is, in fact, the right way to be. So here we are at this point where we're seeing, we can see the conditioning and we can use this Vedana to help us begin to see this is my opinion. This is my projection. This is my assumptions. This is not, in fact, reality. And we can get a much broader view of reality. This is not easy to do, though, because this conditioning has created a line of thinking that is, this is the truth. So you are going against your own truth. And that is a difficult thing to do. So we might flesh this out a little bit more with a couple of questions, but that's what I want you to begin to think about. There's a reason why the Buddha in the right view, I mean, right intentions has three thoughts. This vow to do no harm, this vow to be as kind as we can, and this vow of renunciation. Because if we're not willing to live in a space of renunciation, meaning a space of a willingness to let go of my preferences, then we won't be able to see the cyclical nature of dependent origination. We need to have some way to say, I don't always have to get what I want. I don't always have to get what I believe. It doesn't always have to be like that. And that's what helps us begin to see this broader world. All right? So we are going to break up into some small groups for about 10 minutes, it looks like here.
It just really resonated with me about how something will happen and the whole process of how we respond to that is so, so I shared with Cheryl about I'm dealing with a kind of a big potential property problem. And for me, when I get into the all the pieces around fear, what I said to Cheryl is it feels like I go from acknowledging the thought and pleasant, unpleasant stuff, and there's so much glue from all of my history that it's like I jump over craving, I'm immediately into clinging, and of course it's true, and it ain't it awful.
That's right.
And it's so all of that, and just your suggestion that there's a possibility that maybe I could not jump right there. Maybe I could try to at least look at the glue.
Yes, it's because there's a problem, right? So this is why we can't stay at the craving, because there's a problem and the mind immediately wants to fix it. But you can't fix it right now. That's the whole dilemma. It's one of those, it's some things we could fix immediately, but most things have a lasting kind of quality to them. And so it's going to take a while before you know what the resolution of this is going to be. That's what the mind wants to rush into some kind of solution. And we can, you know, craving is about learning that we can't avoid all suffering, all pain. We can't avoid that. Dukkha is the nature of this realm. But we can avoid that kind of painful, tormenting reactivity. That's what we can avoid. So it's sort of like reminding yourself, this is going to take a while, Suze. Mm-hmm. There's not going to be any quick fix here. Mm-hmm. We don't know what's going to happen. The mind is just making it up because it doesn't know what's going to happen. So you can still be in the unpleasantness of, I wish this wasn't going on. But you don't have to be in the reactivity of the fear of the mind making up what's going to happen in the future.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Sen.
Hi, Jean.
Hi. I just wanted to thank you for your story about your boys, because it's a wonderful story and I will remember it. It's just so, like, earthy.
It's, yeah. It. So you can see how quickly things change.
Yeah.
In our own lives, it's always changing. That's how we go from day to day. That's how we move throughout the day. We think we're doing something, but really it's our Vedana pushing us into this and that and pushing us here and there. And it's just seeing that yeah. pushing.
And thinking it's real. Thinking.
Yeah, and thinking it's real.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, Nalio, Venerable Nalio, he's a resident monk at BCBS, Buddhist, Barry Center for Buddhist Studies. It's right next to IMS. Analia one time said that non-attachment is a balanced relationship with whatever is arising. So what it means is, it's non-attachment is not non-dislike. It's not that. It's not, oh, I'm not going to be upset about anything. I'm not going to not like anything. I'm going to like everything. I'm going to be okay with everything. That's what our thinking mind thinks, right? I'm not attached, so I'm good with everything. Indifference, whatever. Everything's good. Doesn't matter. I don't have any unpleasant. I don't have any pleasant. Everything's good. But really what non-attachment is a balanced relationship with whatever is rising. So we're learning it's much more easier to be balanced when we're in the craving stage. It's much harder. We need renunciation when we're in the clinging stage. But in this craving stage, we can begin to see that there are areas in my life where I could just have a more balanced relationship with the unpleasant, a more balanced relationship with the pleasant. A more balanced relationship with this idea that nothing's going on. I don't have to just immediately fall into boredom, nothing's happening, spacing out. even with me and television, I thought I had to never watch TV again because I'm so addicted to it. But it's not. I don't have to be always watching TV, and I don't have to be no TV. I could have a balanced relationship with TV, but it means I'm going to have to pay attention to the Vedana and the wanting and what's actually happening with this grasping onto TV when I really just am overwhelmed and I don't want to do any more work. Do you see? That's what we're aiming for. Balanced relationship with objects, with experiences, with our opinions, our thinking, our thoughts, you know, the moments. Good.
That ties into something we talked about in the discussion last week about how to deal with really strong triggers. I think you brought that up, Akila, last time, you know, and that idea of being balanced, bringing some balance to those triggers, those really strong political or angry, or, you know, all of what's coming in. It just seems to really tie into where we went last week. So I thought I'd.
Yeah.
I don't know if you felt that acutely.
Most of our triggers is that we want the whole world to be like what I think. And for some reason, my doing what I think in my politics by myself, you know, you're not going to be by yourself, though, because there are many people that believe similarly. But for some reason, we have a mind, and all humans have it, that we think everybody should think like we think. So if we think we should do this, then everybody should think that. And so that balanced relationship is not, oh, I should not think this way. I should think more in line with other people, or I should agree with other people. It's not that. Balanced relationship is, if this is something that's important to me, I need to cultivate ways to get involved and engage with it. Not because I think the whole world needs to do it, but because I need to do it. It's important to me. And then there's a way in which you are living out of your own values and feeling a sense of strength in that, you are not living out of what other people are doing or what other people should be doing. You're living your life out of what's real and true for you. And something about that begins to give us a lot more stability. I think sometimes when we get really overly triggered, it's because we're not really living out of what we want to live out of. And we're upset that the whole world isn't doing it, so it would be easier for me to live out of my own values. But sometimes our values are going against the grain.
Right.
And that's going to make living out of those values just a tad bit harder than it would be if we lived in a society where everybody was practicing some degree of non-harm. But we don't live in that. We got to do it by ourselves. And we got to hold that value and cultivate it for ourselves and for all beings, whether they're doing it or not. All right. I think we have a minute, so I better stop talking because, you know, it's hard for me to stop. It's hard to get started, and then it's hard for me to stop. All right. Lauren.
Yes. So thank you, everybody, for participating today. And in closing, I'd like to remind you that we do accept Donna, the teachers at Sims. You can donate on the donation tab on the Sims website, and there's also a place, for example, for Tweri, just her PayPal or your Zelle. I'm not sure which it is, but it's very easy to do, and they offer the teachings freely, and they appreciate very much any generosity that you offer. Sims also needs to maintain the website and manage the retreats that we have, so some support for Sims is also very much appreciated.
You may not know this, but Sim still pays rent.
Oh, that's a good thing too. Yeah. I thought they might, because I thought they might have a lease. So yes, they
still pay the rent.
Pay the rent. So those are the main things that are coming up. And now, just to close, we'll take a moment to be still and in gratitude for our involvement today at the Sunday Sit, for our meditation, our investigations, our connection with each other. We would like to offer the merit of this practice today to all beings. May all beings be free in their minds of ignorance and hatred. May they all live with peace and ease and well-being.